Robin Miller, another edition of the Week in IndyCar News. Fernando Alonso at Barber Motorsports Park. What was that like? Seemed like you had a ton of fun, but I had to stay home. I had some family business to look after. You were there. What was it like having the two-time champ in and around Barber?
Well, I think, to put it mildly, I think if you can make a good first impression, he made a colossal first impression just because his press conference was like Alex Zanardi's used to be. Funny, honest. I mean, he had people rolling with his answers about somebody asking him how his fellow drivers thought of him coming to Indy. He said, I don't talk to him. He says, if I just talk to him, they just give him one more thing to be miserable about or something like that. I mean, he was delightful. And then the 5 minutes I got to spend with him on the video that you kindly edited, he was just very straightforward, honest, kind of humble. But you could tell, I talked to Zach Brown just for a little bit, but I mean, you could tell, it's like this guy's been given a reprieve. He's actually got one chance this year to be competitive, and it's in a car and a race he's never been in before, which I think is pretty interesting because, you know, he relishes trying to do a good job. And Nigel Roebuck, our buddy across the pond, said he's been wanting to come here for 10 years. So I think the whole thing was the media was excited, the fans were excited, the other drivers and teams. I mean, that was absolutely. I think everybody there embraced him, and he embraced the whole scene.
I don't think Wolfgang was there, so he might not have gotten his two questions, but that's why. I hear that's the real reason why he's going to Indy, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. One of the things that you learned early in the weekend that also was discussed during the broadcast, pretty cool, our boy Gildy, Mr. Gilles DeFerrin, will be Fernando's driver coach. We know that Pagano credits Gilles for being his mentor, his Yoda, his guru, when he unfortunately didn't make the immediate transition from Champ Car to IndyCar, went over to sports cars with Gilles' team. Definitely, again, credit Gilles for being just, you know, massively influential in helping him to learn, develop, and grow. I know Rick Mears is a hell of an Indy 500 educator. I don't know, and I'm not saying he isn't, but I don't know if Gilles is that caliber of a coach. What do you know? What do you think?
Well, I think he's got Mario and Michael, two of the best guys ever at Indy, to help him. And Gilles, I think, is going to be, you know, I think they're, you know, Mario's got all kinds of stuff. He'll be there some, you know, quite a bit of May. Michael will be there every day, but he's trying to run the whole team. And he's going to call Alonso's race. But I think Gilles, he's kind of a commie, and, you know, he's very, you know how he is. He's pretty docile. He doesn't scream and yell. I think he's pretty pragmatic, and that's kind of the way he approached ovals. And I think, you know, it was just funny. We were sitting at Honda, and he comes wandering in. I go, oh, look, it's Fernando Alonso's driver coach. And he gives me one of those looks like, shut up. He comes over and sits down, and I go, so I hear you're going to coach him. And he goes, I can't talk about it. I said, oh, eight people care. Of course you can talk about it. And then about an hour later, Zach Brown says in the press conference, and by the way, Gilles DeFerrin will be Fernando's coach. And I'm standing next to DeFerrin at the press conference. I'm like, really? Let's keep it a secret. But, I mean, I like Gilles just because he's, you know, he's an engineer. He's smart. And I think Fernando, you know, the danger is you don't want to have too many coaches. But, you know, I just think from everything that Roebuck's told me and everything that Rubens Barrichello told TK, this guy's one of the three best he's ever seen, right there with Senna and Schumacher in the last 30, 35 years, and he'll figure it out, and, you know, it just depends on how fast he'll figure out. I guess he was on the simulator for a whole day, and, you know, I just think that it's like anything else. Teo Fabi hated it when he came over here, and, you know, 3 or 4 months later, he was on the pole. I don't think Alonso's going to be like that. I think he's going to like it right away.
And I think part of the job that he is going to have to do for himself is to start to tune out some of those voices if there are too many coming in. Because, you know, he has everybody and everything that he needs. We also learned and confirmed this week that he's going to have Eric Bretzman, Andretti's new technical director, engineering his car. And this, you know, you and I know Eric, think the world of him. You know, he and Dixon, if you think of the majority of Scott Dixon's success in IndyCar, and he's, what, number five on the all-time win list? The majority of that came with Eric on the timing stand. Obviously, he's gone on to win another championship and a lot more races with Chris Simmons today. But if you look overall, the Dixon-Bretzman train, that thing just motored through IndyCar for 12 years. Thinking of someone to pair with Fernando, I think Eric is definitely someone you talk about. Calm, cool, pragmatic, plus just really easygoing. So whatever stress there might be or Fernando might be feeling, I look at an Eric, I look at a Gilles, so, you know, there's definitely those calming influences you mentioned.
Yeah, Kahn said, Ruben, he said, what do you think? I asked Alonso about Servi, and he said, yeah, they're good buddies, but they hadn't really talked yet. And Rubens Barrichello told TK, the two things he'll have to really get used to are the last 20 laps of the race when you have no friends and you think you do, and the mob of people on race day that are going to want his picture and his autograph, and just the when you walk after your Formula One car, there's 10 people and he'll never see anything like he's seen. And Kanaan and I were laughing. I think it'll be funny when they tell him, now, Fernando, tomorrow's autograph session is only an hour, and then the next day is only 30 minutes, and he'll go, what autograph session?
For the team? No.
You mean me?
There are people that are going to be at the gate at 6 a.m.
He was signing autographs outside Andretti's Hospitality and on the grid, so I think he's going to enjoy it. It looked like he was relieved to be away from Formula One, and I think he'll enjoy it.
So this will be our last, actually it'll be our second to last Fernando Alonso topic for this week's edition. The other thing I've been mentioning, and you and I have been talking about a little bit, we're going to have to manage, not just you and I, but I think the media in general, we're going to have to manage the Fernando Alonso overload, because there's going to be 32 other drivers there vying for the win. I think, 20-plus drivers who are going to be ready to win. And, while this is a cool and amazing thing, probably a once-in-a-lifetime for those who are, newer to IndyCar racing, came after Mansell came over and did all this. There is the concern that, all right, so if we're doing 24 hours a day and Fernando Alonso had a seat fitting and he was on the simulator and he had a cookie with his lunch and he bought a new pair of shoes in Speedway in the end. I mean, there's the risk of, or I would think there's going to be a risk of possibly alienating Indy 500 fans, IndyCar fans, and just having the average person saying, okay, good God, Fernando Alonso, I actually want to hear about Buddy Lazier, because at least that would be something new to hear about. So, again, I think from now through the end of the month of May, hopefully there will be a little bit of recognition that, come on, guys, we cannot turn this into Fernando Alonso's Indy 500, presented by Penn Great Oil.
Yeah, and I don't really think they will. It was kind of like Kurt Busch. He got a lot of attention when he had his test. He qualified. It was going back and forth. But he was just part of the show, and I think that's what Alonso will be. I think next Wednesday, weather permitting, will be a big day for him because he's going to be on the track all day by himself, and I think that'll get great media coverage. And then, he'll go back and run the Spanish Grand Prix and come back and be ready for the Indy 500.
Another thing that we learned about from last weekend, and on the topic of folks who are chasing willpower, obviously our boy Joseph Newgarden won. Happy to see that for him. I don't think any of us expected him to be in that position until Power had that tire go down, but he was really impressive. The guy, though, that I just thought drove the race of the race was Scott Dixon. Speaking with him after, speaking with some of the other engineers after the race, really was able to further appreciate Dixon's performance, because he was one of very few Hondas up front and competitive the entire race. And then you find out that in maximum downforce, the Honda guys are looking at something in the range of 300 pounds less downforce than the Chevy runners. You start to realize that if you've got a car that's making, over 5,000 pounds of downforce, an extra 300 might not sound like much, but that's the difference between having Charles Barkley, laying on top of the thing or not. That is going to help create grip and speed through the corners at a place like Barber and at Phoenix, where we're headed this weekend, and on the other short ovals. You think at the last two races, though, the street races, and you go, well, they're in max downforce there, too. Shouldn't the Chevys be able to kick butt there? Well, keep in mind, there aren't that many fast corners, like truly fast corners where that downforce comes into play out of St. Pete or out of Long Beach. So Honda, with their really strong engines, all the extra torque and acceleration they've found, the impressive top end, that motor is what really made the difference at the two street races. And that's part of why we saw them win. You get to Barber, where you're in max downforce, but that max downforce now gets put to use in the corners. Not a surprise that the Penske Chevys were dominating everything and running up front, you know, from the opening practice session until the end of the race. Then you look at Honda and you go, all right, well, how many Hondas are up there? Not many, but look who it is. It's Dixon. And you watch the footage of the race, you watch him working from inside the car, and the thing is squirming and slithering and you name it. And again, it's 300 pounds, it's not life or death difference, but just that little lack, that minor decrease in downforce, means that this guy is having to work minor miracles to keep up with power and you know, be able to fight with Joseph. So altogether, you know, it's hard to say that he, you know, I don't know where it rates among Dixie's great career drives, but he had the potential of winning. Obviously, Joseph got by, great pass, went on to win. But altogether, I think what we saw at Barber is going to set the table for Phoenix, for Iowa, for Mid-Ohio, for a lot of other places where big downforce is really truly what translates into getting a victory lane.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dixon probably was the fastest guy through 1, 2, 3, and maybe 4 and 5, or 1, 2, 3. And Newgarden was just ate him up the last three or four corners, and Dixon said, man, I never even got... Dixon had twice as much push to pass with about 10 laps to go and never could make it. And after the race, I mean, Roger Penske was like, just, can you believe he held off Scott Dixon? I mean, he was so excited, you know, he was so happy because I think he understood that, you know, anytime you can hold pass Dixon and hold him off, you've accomplished... It's a pretty big accomplishment. But it's funny about Newgarden is people were saying, oh, after the first race, well, you know, it's going to take him a while to catch on. Yeah, well, let's see. He was fourth. He qualified fourth at the first race, finished eighth. Then he finished second the second race. And this race, he won and would have been in the fast six, but he tried to use a set of scuffed reds to try and save a set of reds for the fast six and just barely missed it. I mean, this guy, get used to it because he's going to be up there a lot. And that's no surprise to us. I mean, that's no surprise to anybody that's watched him. But I thought, you know, Rossi drove a good race. He was the other Honda that was pretty impressive.
Very true. Yeah, I mean, that kid, he might not have a lot to say when he's outside of the car, but he's definitely one who does his speaking behind the wheel. And I'm with you. This is, it's cool to see. Because, right, one of the things that it's hard to say is, yeah, this kid was kicking butt in Formula BMW USA. Then he went over to Europe and bounced around a lot, went through a lot of series, got to F1 with a really with crappy teams. Never had a chance to really tell the world whether he had amassed a lot of experience, tapped into some huge talent. Or, I mean, again, you don't know. You just don't know. Comes here last year. Everything is essentially new, never done ovals, hasn't been to most of the tracks, and starts picking up, starts showing that he's not only getting this, but can be, you know, a pretty close tail gunner to Hunter Ray at a couple races, closes the year really strong at Sonoma, and we come in this year, and guess what? Yeah, the kid's the real deal. Now, am I saying if we threw him back to F1 and said, all right, Valtteri, you're out of that Mercedes ride, and, you know, Rossi's going to be knocking Hamilton off his perch? I don't know if I'd go that far, but I'd say we definitely found that this kid has serious talent, and maybe not all the luck. Maybe it's going to take a little bit longer for things to fully come together, but I'm with you. He's we're getting into something I'd wanted to jump into. It's our you always do your awesome mid-season report card. We've done 3 out of 17 races, so we're not even getting close to that, but we'll call it, we're 17.6% done with the season, Miller. So let's talk a little bit about even just through these first three races. Some of the surprises, positive or negative, with our 21-ish, 22 full-time drivers. Who stood out so far that surprised you? And who has yet to live up to what you thought they might be doing at this somewhat early stage?
Bourdais winning races is not a surprise. Them leading the championship is. Hinch winning a race isn't a surprise. It was a great story. I think Spencer Pigot's driven really well. I think Ed Jones has driven really well. Maybe Spencer doesn't have the results. I mean, he passed a bunch of cars at Barber just like he did at St. Pete, and he spun lapping a car, and he was pretty hard on himself coming home Sunday night. But I mean, the kid's showing he's got some chops, and I mean, that's how you're going to keep that ride if you impress people like that. Probably the fact that Castroneves has been so fast and qualifying and not really got a result. Like, I mean, he got fourth yet. I mean, he just doesn't have, he hadn't won a race in a couple years, and I think he's going to break through because he's still, my God, look how fast he is. But he's probably disappointed he hadn't won a race yet. Same with TK. But I think Kanaan will be, he's got two ovals coming up. I think he's pretty happy about that. Probably Rahal Lanigan Letterman's probably the biggest disappointment because they've been so strong the last 2 years and carried the Honda banner. And, you know, Graham's really struggled in practice and qualifying. And he threw one lap together at Long Beach, out of the clear blue sky. And all weekend at Barber, he had one really good lap, put him like seventh in one of the practice sessions, I think it was Saturday morning, but, you know, didn't come close when qualifying with her. So they got their work cut out for him. I think he'll get some help next month with Serbia. That'll be probably the godsend for him because a one-car team going up against Ganassi and Penske and Andretti the way Honda's running, it's going to be tough.
Remember this day, boys and girls. This is the day where you throw this back in my face, and I know this ahead of time. Takuma Sato. I will raise my hand and say I thought this was just going to be a continuation of the same old dumpster fire we've seen for years and years and years. He is eighth in points. Again, this is the Pruitt. You're talking about the 17.6% mark in the season, so don't let your monkey ass get too far ahead in making claims, but at least so far, I've been impressed by Sato. I spoke with Hunter Ray. Hunter Ray said the same thing. Like, you know, I don't know what to expect. We all know his reputation. I mean, his reputation precedes him as a guy who's quick but always crashes, makes the same mistakes over and over again, and at least through this three races and 17.6% mark, the guy's been pretty darn smart and shown us that, you know, there is certainly quality left in the guy. So I've been pleased for him. I've looked at Aloshin as somebody who I thought we would be getting more out of by this point. All of a sudden, you know, we can say for sure that Hinch is delivering at a high level and is certainly the bar of measurement within the Schmidt-Peterson Motorsports team. And with Hinch sitting fifth in the championship with a win already, and McHale sitting 12th, he did finish 10th at Barber, which is great, but he has three finishes so far of 10th or lower. I thought we'd be seeing a little bit more from our Russian friend. Beyond that, you know, Marco, at least in testing, preseason testing, and even in-season testing, has shown us that he might be turning a page. The results haven't been there. And obviously Barber, you know, through no fault of his own, that cartoon animal smacked his car right out of the gate. So, you know, not a ton of surprises. I'm with you on Pigot. Obviously he was mad at himself for making a mistake, but at this stage of your career, if you're going as quickly as you are and having to, at Barber, take the team lead, knowing that Zach Veach is coming in to make his debut, you know, that kid has the kind of potential which can be groomed into something special. So those who impressed me beyond everyone that you mentioned, Takuma for sure, I'm hoping that the black cloud following our boy Connor Daly dissipates. Hopefully Jerry Hildebrand has something to smile about before here too long. And I think our friends at AJ Foyt Racing as well, just all together, starting to look like they're getting a hang of it with this new Chevy, this new everything. So anyways, it'll be interesting to see what happens this weekend at Phoenix. And then we start to get into a busy month of May. You know, the last major Barber-related topic, Robin, which You know, this is the stuff, this is where I came up, this is where I started working, and what I love, the Mazda Road to Indy. Colton Herta, Hertamania, Mini Hertamania, another win. Nico Jamin also won a race there. And if you look in USF 2000, the Florida Flash, Oliver Askew, that kid is kicking ass and taking names beyond Colton and Indy Lights. I think this Askew kid is building just as big of a following from those in the IndyCar ranks, cheering him on, rooting for him, you name it. And this kid's at the bottom rung of the ladder. So just a really, really sharp weekend for the kids coming up.
Yeah, I think what's great about Colton Herta's story is the whole Steinbrenner family was there. They all had three motor homes. I mean, the whole family, sisters, brothers, grandmas, fathers, aunts, it was unbelievable. The Victory Lane picture, I mean, there's 40 people in it. And that's exactly what IndyCar needs, is George Michael. He's a young man, and he's a little Hertamania's. He wants to go to IndyCar racing with him, and my God, they may be there before they think, because if he wins $1 million, it's going to be pretty tough to say, I think we're going to stand Indy Lights another year, because that probably wouldn't happen. But Askew is really good. And you'll help me out here, but there was a 14-year-old kid that was tearing him up over the weekend. He had some trouble. Was it Mazda? Was it the Pro Mazda or the F2000?
No, F2000. No, he was chasing Askew home the whole time. And yeah, that kid's definitely
14.
I know.
And Flynn Lazier, buddy's son, made his debut and went from 22nd to 12th and did a nice job on Sunday. And had never been in a car, you know, with that. He'd never been in one of those cars before, so. He's somebody that I think, you know, I mean, there's an abundance of talent, and a lot of them are Americans, and that's kind of cool.
And then we have some interesting news this week, not in the IndyCar world, but that Dale Earnhardt Jr. announced his retirement on Tuesday. So you go, all right, Prue, what the hell does that have to do with IndyCar? Nothing. Nothing at all. I mean, I'm not, you know, will he ever want to race at the 500? I don't know. I mean, I doubt it.
No. But I can answer that for you.
But what I... In context, on Tuesday, Dale Earnhardt Jr. stopped the world by announcing that he would be retiring, 42-year-old Dale Earnhardt Jr. On Wednesday, 46-year-old Mamo Gidley, just one of the great living inspirations on the planet, IndyCar driver supreme, someone who's raced everything with excellence, let the world know that he finished third last weekend on the podium in his first race back after breaking everything from the waist down in 2014 at the Rolex 24 at Daytona. So, not saying this in a critical way about Dale Jr. at all, but it wasn't lost on me that on Tuesday we had one driver who's earned everything and has had to go through some definite health and physical issues, decided he's going to call time on a career at the end of the year. Meanwhile, the next day, we have someone who's 46 at a time when you go, geez, buddy, you were really busted up bad a couple years ago. You know, shouldn't you become a real estate agent or something else? No, Mamo's fighting his ass off to relaunch his career, stay in the saddle, keep going. I know you love the guy. I love the guy. He drove for me once. That part to me, just in our general IndyCar world, just reminds me about the fighting spirit of the people who we really love and cherish.
Well, I mean, shifter carts, I think that's what he got third in a shifter cart race, right?
Yeah, it was a karting event.
Which is, you know, they're pretty lethal. They go pretty quick. But, you know, how badly he was banged up, and we've seen him a lot in the last couple of years. He'd show up at Sonoma, and, you know, I mean, he was a super sub when he was in kart and did some really good things. And Dale Earnhardt Jr. is a class act, and he's...
Absolutely.
You know, he's the only time I was around him, I spent the day with him in Charlotte one time and rode around with him in a real stock car, and it was for wind tunnel. And he's very, very articulate, very, very well. He thinks about what he's going to say, and I think that, you know, he'll probably end up in the TV booth, I would imagine, which is fine. I mean, I think that'd be good. It's just, it's interesting. He wants to... Go on his own, quit on his own terms, and so does Mimo.
I keep hearing he wants to do IndyCar grid runs, so we might be trying to find a job here pretty soon.
Kanaan
buddy.
Already told me he'll have that job in a couple years, so I better become a gaffer.
It's going to look like a Brazilian garden gnome running down down pit lane.
That's right.
That'll be great. All right, so we're going to wrap up here with a question that came in from.
Wait a minute, we got to say AJ Foyt's on the men.
Oh, that's right. Good Lord.
He talked to him this morning, or around lunchtime, and he just got home from the hospital, had a stem cell treatments a couple weeks ago in Mexico, and today they had, he had some surgery on his foot, and they didn't have to whack any toes off, so he was pretty happy. He's going to miss Phoenix, but he'll be at Indy the whole month.
And he was mad that they wouldn't pour the stem cells into a chocolate shake and stir it up for him, too. Is that true
or false? He went to Mexico, Marshall, because just like when he was healing from Elkhart Lake, he said, what's the fastest way I can heal? And they said, pure oxygen, hyperbolic chamber. He said, well, how do I do that? And they said, well, most people can take about 5 minutes a day. It's pretty painful. So Foyt says, I'm on 30 minutes in the morning and 30 minutes in the afternoon. And that's what he did. And he healed up in, God knows, record time. And so the stem cell, he went to Mexico because you can get so much, the dosage is so much larger in Mexico than it is in the United States, and that's why he went. He's kind of a badass. Yes, he is.
Well, we have a question that came in from Peter Peel. I apologize, I'm probably mangling your last name, but it's all good. I got the Peter part right, though. Peter was asking Robin about the origins of Alonso coming to Indy. And I think we've told most of this, and I think a fair amount of this has been written, but spoke with Zach Brown today and said, all right, you know, let's be honest. How much of this Indy 500 deal was about pleasing Fernando? Everyone knows he is the world's highest paid slash angriest Formula One driver because he doesn't have anything to drive, you know, a car worth driving right now. But how much of this was really the appeasement tour? All right, so if you're going to hate life every time you show up for an F1 race, what can we do to make you happy elsewhere while we get our act together? And he said, I wouldn't go that far. He said, this is really something that we wanted to do, McLaren. And he said, look, if everything we did was about pleasing people, then every single person at McLaren would be lining up my door and, you know, telling me what to do and what to pay for to bring them to that same state of happiness. Whether that's accurate or not, I'll leave that for folks to determine. But what do you know about the sequence of how this went down, of how Fernando Alonso coming to Indy really manifested and started to gain traction behind the scenes?
I have to disagree with Zach. I think they are throwing him a bone. He's in his contract. He's a free agent at the end of the year. They're trying to keep him happy. And, you know, I mean, Honda of Japan, did they, I don't know how much money they're giving Michael Andretti to run him. I mean, probably a couple million. Is that Honda of Japan and McLaren splitting it? I don't know. But he's always one to run Indy. Nigel Roebuck said for the last 10 years, that's all he's talked about. I got to run Indy someday. So obviously, the timing probably couldn't have been better. It looks like Honda's, you know, obviously got their act together and they're pretty strong, and everybody thinks they're going to have the most horsepower at Indy. So what better opportunity for Fernando to come over here? Yeah, he's got to miss Monaco. Well, Jimmy Clark did too, and so did Mario once. So it's just, you know, I think it's timing and it's throwing him a bone. And I think, you know, Zach's been pretty upfront with you about, hell yeah, we want to have an IndyCar team someday, but we got to get our act together over here first. So it's all good, to quote Marshall Pruitt, and that's exactly why this is going to be a big story for a long time.
And I also, you know, no discredit to Mark Miles, but I think as Zach described this, and Mark has even described this, Zach rang Mark. Mark didn't exactly wake up in the morning and say, Fernando Alonso, Indy 500, must happen. So, you know, I mean, Zach has something to protect in Alonso. Now, do we know if McLaren is going to be able to give him a car with an engine that is worthy of his talents by the end of this year, in 2018, 2019? I don't know. Can't tell you. But I know that they firmly believe they need to have the best drivers possible to give themselves the best shot of making the most out of whatever they have. And with Fernando, yeah, I mean, they could probably go and try and hire someone else, pick up, you know, a younger driver, less accomplished, for a much cheaper rate. But you're not going to come anywhere near this guy's fighting capability. So when your prized fighter is bummed out and not too happy with his day job, doesn't surprise me if you're looking for a little bit of work on the side, a little bit of extracurricular weekend activities to keep him plugged in and happy. So, Peter, that I would say is the most accurate, despite whomever said what. I think that's probably the most accurate way to describe how this went down. with Alonso in a bad and grumpy place and the ability to leave at the end of the year, I too would be brainstorming various ways to keep him happy if I couldn't do that in his normal role. All right, Miller, we've got Phoenix this weekend. I've already said, and I'll go out on the limb, it's not much of a limb at all, but I say that as if it matters, that Chevy is going to go 2 for 2. Granted, you know, that's in normal conditions. If there's some 10-car pileup and all the Chevys are taken out, you know, come on, cut me a break. But I think based purely on what we saw at Barber and their high downforce capabilities, we should see 2 for 2, and I might think we could even go 3 for 3. Once we get through the GP of Indy. But anyways, we've got Phoenix this weekend. You and I will be there. That should be fairly awesome. At that event, there's also going to be some really cool vintage Indy cars that will not only be on display, but also be on track. So you and I are going to be geeks watching them every time they go out. So that should be fun. And we're going to close this week in IndyCar with a little conversation that I had with one Joseph Newgarden about his win last weekend and the reception that he had from within the team. So obviously this is his first time winning for the captain, but I wanted to know what it was like getting away from victory lane and how he was received not only by the captain, but by the rest of the team. So for my man, Robin Miller, off we go with Joseph Newgarden, and we will speak to you next week. And Mr. Newgarden, what's it like getting back after all the Victory Lane celebrations to hear whatever the captain has to say or Tim has to say?
A lot of it's just business as usual. I think these guys, you know, they expect you to go out and do your job, and really all of us, all four of us, you know, we felt like we had the four best Indy cars there at Barber with Team Penske, and so one of us needed to secure the victory for the team. And it doesn't matter which one, they just need someone in Victory Lane, and it'd be great if all of us are following up right behind. But, you know, what's fun to see is how enthusiastic and how excited these guys get for a victory. You know, every single victory, it doesn't matter which one it is. You know, you see Roger in Victory Lane, and, you know, you get to shake his hand, and you see how excited he was that we were able to win the race for the team. And it's the same thing with Tim. I mean, these guys, look, they love going racing, and just because they expect to do well and, you know, they feel like we have everything in place to do well, they still get so excited beating everybody at the racetrack because they know how difficult that is. They know what it takes to get it done. And so you really get a sense of that from those guys after the race with how thrilled they are with the accomplishment.
I love the fact that Roger seemed to appreciate and value your performance based on who you beat, right? It's not just that you got a win. It's a fact that you threw down a pass on the inside of Scott Dixon. That kind of never happens. And then you controlled the pace. Obviously, Will had an unfortunate tire problem. But I think Roger came away feeling fairly happy with his decision to bring you on. Was that also something that you appreciated? The fact that you didn't just win, but you also had to go out and pass, you know, one of the best, if not the best, of his generation of IndyCar drivers, and then keep him behind you.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it was a tough race. There was kind of everything thrown in at it. You know, we had to pass cars. We had to save fuel. We had to figure out tire strategy. You know, we had to have good pit stops. You really needed a complete race to be up front there. And there's no doubt that, you know, Will was controlling the race. It was us trying to beat him, and the same thing with Scott. You know, we were trying to beat Will that day with what he was doing. He was up front all day and was hard to beat. So, you know, we both caught a break with him having the tire misfortune, which is always gutting. But this is racing. You know, you have to be in a position to capitalize when that type of circumstance arises. You know, and all of a sudden you find yourself in the lead. But it was not easy. I mean, and that's what I say about, you know, Tim and Roger, you know, being so excited about the victory. They know how difficult it is to beat the other teams, to beat Gasly, to beat Scott. And exactly what you said, Scott is one of the most difficult guys to beat on the racetrack when it comes to fuel mileage, when it comes to race management, when it comes to just racing in general when you're trying to pass the guy. So it was a difficult race. I mean, it was hard to win that thing. And I think, you know, it didn't really matter if it was Will or me. I mean, if Will didn't have the tire issue, we would have been just as thrilled that Will we would have been just as excited that he won the race. And I watched the race back, and I saw Tim being interviewed mid-race, and you could see the not the anxiety, but just the level of concentration that, hey, you know, we're in the lead 1-2 with Willamy, but we got Scott right there. That's the other guy. And we've still got to make sure that we get this race under our belts and completed when the checkered flag flies. So it was difficult, just all around very, very challenging.
Other thing that impressed me and I thought was fun, it was a really good jolt of energy and warmth, was your Victory Lane interview with NBCSN. So not only did you, in a very honest way, thank all of your sponsors, right? It didn't feel like, and I want to thank 1, 2, 3 and 4, 5, 6 and they helped me, blah, blah. It was real, like, you called all of them out. I know that the entire Penske PR team was smiling at the job you did there, but again, it wasn't forced, it wasn't robotic. The other thing that I loved, though, and I would suggest that you do this with all future wins, is you had essentially your entire team in the interview, directly behind you. So instead of you being away and separated, you know, I'm picking out, you know, every single guy behind you, that whether it was changed tire, refueled, you name it. Just would suggest that as you get more wins, make sure to step back into your team to make sure that they all get some of the love and credit too once the camera starts rolling.
Yeah, no, I think you probably saw a little more energy from me in that interview. You know, normally I pull back a little bit on those moments just because I'm so happy for everybody. But yeah, I don't know what it was. I just had a little more energy that time around. I just felt really good. You know, once I saw the guys in Victory Lane, and you know, I think it's been more of a process for me this time around in the off season to build the relationships up with the guys on the 2 car, but then you know also everyone at Team Penske that works in the cars and works at the shop. So I don't know. I think just when I saw those guys, I just got enthusiastic, and I felt the energy of what we had done and how difficult the race was. So I was really pleased. But I always wish we could pass off the interview to someone different on the team every time. That would be pretty cool. But I don't think they're gonna allow me to do that. If we could have a little rotation between the guys, it would be great.
Well, I don't know who they is. They is you, man. I think you just step back and say, hey, Fred, tell me about our second pit stop. You killed it. Tell everyone what you did. You know, you're in control there.
I'll just grab the mic next time from Marty and just say, hey, man, I'm going to do the interview here, and I'll interview one of the guys. So that's a great idea, actually.
And then send NBC a bill for your talent services. All right, last dumb question for you. Obviously, a lot of people happy to see you win. Tell me about some of the cool or maybe even the unexpected texts or calls or emails from folks who you know, wanted to celebrate with you and congratulate you on your results.
You know, I think probably one of the best things was seeing the Twitter. How old am I?
Okay, Grandpa. The tweeters and the book faces, yes.
Yeah, the tweets. You know, I saw a couple tweets from some cool guys like Jimmy Johnson, and you know we got a little lucky with the rain in Bristol, so you know that allowed those guys to tune in because they weren't busy. But it's just you know it's cool that people from all across the sport you know watch what we're doing in the IndyCar world because it's the exact same from our side. You know when we're not racing in IndyCar. Or even when we are at the same point, when we record the races and we watch it back, and you know, I keep track of everything. I love watching the guys in NASCAR or Formula One or sports car racing or whatever. You know, it's just great to follow the sport and see the other, you know, great talent out there, and to get a couple tweets from guys like Jimmy Johnson and
didn't
you
know, he double your tweet you as well?
Yeah, I saw that. I saw Darren Waltrip, you know, which is probably a rare one for IndyCar. So, you know, that's cool. That's great for the sport that those guys are watching and appreciating what we're doing and, you know, just everyone in IndyCar and them appreciating the show. I kind of like seeing that. I thought that was a great thing.